Welcome today to Interview Series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Jeff Anders, International Innovation Leader and Strategist, co-founder and CEO of The Mark. Jeff, you have a diverse background of international success and innovation, business and strategy. Thank you for sharing your deep experiences and insights with our audience.
That's my pleasure, Steve.
Jeff, can you start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself and your past roles?
Absolutely. Well, my background is primarily in business. I did an undergraduate degree in finance, and then went on to do 5 years of management consulting, essentially strategy and operations for Fortune 1000 companies. Did that for about 5 years. Left there to go do a master's, an MBA at MIT, and a master's in public administration at Harvard. Focusing essentially on the emerging knowledge economy in developing countries, how that was changing business, and the impact that was having on countries like Canada and the U.S., and what governments should be doing in those countries to contend with the new competitive challenges. So I worked in startup companies in both India and China. And then the end of that sort of phase of my career, I got involved with Michael Ignatieff, who was my professor at the Kennedy School before he returned to Canada to run for Parliament, and joined his policy team, worked there for about a year, thinking about what he should do if he were to become Prime Minister. Of course, that's quite relevant now as we are on the verge of an election. And when I stopped doing that, set out to figure out what my next move would be, and ended up here where I am today as founder of The Mark News.
Well, Jeff, you know, you have this really interesting background, as you've indicated in your brief summary there. So how would you describe your top innovative achievements in terms of the problems you're trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the future?
Good question. I think the key, I'll take these one at a time, I guess. The problems, I think, throughout my career in consulting, and then dealing with policy questions, and thinking about countries like China and India, ultimately these are all problems that don't have a precedent. There is no textbook answer to what one should do, and that pretty much characterized the problems, which makes it really exciting, because, you know, the temptation is to try to, what we used to call in consulting, boil the ocean, try to find the solution. In fact, you have to be much more structured in your thinking, deliberate in it, and not to overuse the word, but innovative in trying to come up with solutions. And I think what characterizes the solutions, pretty much I would boil it down to two key characteristics. And one is the effectiveness of the solution, so depending on what the desired goal is. But the second is the ease of implementation. And I think that, you know, from everything I've done, being quite realistic about implementation has been absolutely critical. You know, if a tree falls in the woods, that kind of thinking. And in terms of impact, what is the impact it has today and into the future? I'd say that for the most part, The impact I've tried, the solutions that I've tried to build, I have conceived in terms of creating an enduring impact, some impact that would be disproportionate to the resources that were invested, the time that was invested.
So you talked about The Mark. Can you overview the origins of The Mark?
Sure. I talked a little bit about the work I was doing about, you know, on the knowledge economy in developing countries. And everybody who is really smart and has written on this subject pretty much says the same thing. I say that a country's prosperity into the future will come down to its ability to innovate. And what is innovation? I mean, I guess they mean intellectual property, ultimately ideas. So when I think about The Mark, and I'll tell you a little bit, I guess we'll get to that, what The Mark is and what it hopes to achieve. Essentially, The Mark tries to showcase Canadian ideas and propel the thinkers behind those ideas. So one of the origins, to recap, is the MARC aims to sort of harvest Canadian ideas and bring them to market. So that's one thrust. The other thrust that brought me here was my work with Michael Ignatieff. And politics aside, what he successfully did was he mobilized between 100 and 200 really extraordinary people, Canadians, working in Canada and all over the world, who had, for the most part, never been engaged in politics before, and who, if they were living abroad, felt a deep sense of Canadianness, but quite often knew very little about the country they loved so much. But when Michael Ignatieff, this international figure, came, you know, was setting out to run for office, he brought with him the promise of a certain intellectualism, a technocratic approach to governance, an internationalist approach, and that resonated with 20 to 35-year-old or 40-year-old people who got on board and volunteered their time. And one of the things that I took from that was, you know, look at all these great people, look at all the great work they're doing, and most of them are virtually unknown. So I wondered if there was a way to build something that would showcase these people, give them a platform where they could publish their ideas whenever they wanted to, of course knowing that the Globe and Mail rejects 99% or so of the submissions to its op-ed page. So, so the MARC was something that would take all the people that I had met on the Michael Ignatieff campaign, along with all other people working for all other campaigns, and great Canadians working in all other professional disciplines, and give them a place where they could communicate the ideas that they had in their heads that very often were being locked up there and not shared.
You know, that's interesting. So it's a communications platform for Canadians and gives them an opportunity to be passionate about a particular idea, build it out. But there's something else that you mentioned earlier, and I was wondering, are you in the venture area as well?
Are we in what, sorry?
In sort of the venture, sort of spawning companies and taking ideas and taking them to market, that kind of thing? Or?
Not explicitly. We are a venture ourselves, and so we are a startup company. But at this point, we are not an incubator or anything like that that is commercializing other technologies. That said, we are building a network of extraordinary Canadians from all professional disciplines. And our mission is to help them do their jobs better. And so essentially, if you think about it, we are positioning ourselves at the very center of this network of people. And I think from that, eventually, all kinds of new ideas will flow through here. And I can't imagine right now what the opportunities would be. But certainly, at least intangibly or informally, our mission is to help those ideas come to market.
So have you gone into sort of like first round of financing or anything beyond angel financing?
Yes, yeah. We were funded by friends and family at first. We recently closed a round of funding. The former CEO of eBay in Canada, Arlene Dickinson, who is from the venture show on CBC, The Dragon's Den. She's also a venture communications, a big marketing firm, and then a number of others. Somebody from founder of a database marketing company has invested in us. So, you know, some people have gotten behind us, and we've raised our first round. And soon we'll be looking for more, of course, such as the life of a startup company.
I see. So that passion that you talked about has resonated with a wider community.
Well, without the passion, they wouldn't have invested. Of course, I think this is an extraordinary business opportunity, and we can talk about why. But the passion was definitely key. And I'll tell you, the business plan and the passion wasn't enough for 49 out of 50 people that we pitched at first, but eventually got it done.
So, you know, and with any new venture and you're trying to do, you know, make a mark, and I guess that's the reason for the name, the MARC, not only in this country, but perhaps worldwide as well. You know, what are some of the obstacles that you're facing right now?
Right now, I mean, the big obstacle right now, as with any content-based business, is trying to be financially sustainable. you know, we came at this and said the newspapers and magazines in this country and all over are having a lot of trouble. How do we build something that would eliminate as much cost as possible? So, you know, we don't have paper or ink or printing presses. We don't have trucks to deliver paper. We don't have any unionized staff. And these are the legacies that, that those companies contend with. But at the same time, we also have figured out a way to get very high-quality content without paying our contributors. And so our revenue model is that is much more of a cost model almost. What we do is we say to extraordinary people, you can't publish in a national publication whenever you want until now. Use the mark as a communications tool for yourself to write whatever you want, whenever you want. We'll edit it for you. We provide them a profile page that links out to their own professional website. It'll feature their books and link readers to Amazon. We do PR on their behalf. So, for example, Bob Ray, for example, wrote here a couple weeks ago, and we did a big push on that in the media and ended up in all kinds of newspapers and magazines, both here and in the U.S. And so because of all these things that we do for them, and we built it deliberately, we don't have to pay them per word or whatever, the way other publications do. And so we've taken a lot of cost out. Now, you've asked me about the major obstacle, and the major obstacle is revenue and how do you monetize this content. And that is right now what we are trying to figure out. You need scale in terms of traffic and audience in order to really monetize it effectively. We're in a race against time here. How fast can we build the audience before the money runs out? And I'd say that's the biggest challenge, but it's going really well.
I see. So it sounds like an ad-based model, though, at some point, right?
Ad-based for now into licensing. Plus, we'll be doing live events quite soon. So ticket sales, more sponsorship. And frankly, our objective is to create, to become a content creation machine that churns out written content, audio content, video content, live event content at a very low cost. And we're getting there pretty quickly.
Okay, so let's say there's somebody in the audience, they're a remarkable Canadian, they have some interesting ideas, they want to get out to this large audience, and they're shut out from the traditional media. How do they get in touch with you? How do they get, what are the opportunities that are available beyond what you've talked about here today?
If somebody wants, you know, we recruit our contributors based on two criteria. One is professional credibility. What do they do in their job? And if their office, if they are somehow at the forefront of their field or changing their field in some way, then they would qualify. And the second is a connection to Canada. So people regularly send us emails and say, hey, I would love to be a contributor. And, of course, we're happy to welcome them in. We accept referrals from other people. So if anybody listening to this thinks of somebody in their network who is truly an extraordinary person and has really interesting ideas to express and could benefit in some way, again, coming back to the incentives, from having a platform at the mark, which they, of course, could use whenever they want, no commitment, then we would encourage you to send us an email. All that's available on our website at themarknews.com. I think the opportunities are to use op-eds thinking as another channel to communicate with stakeholders, with whoever will help them achieve their professional goals.
So what are some compelling op-eds that have recently appeared?
We've had some really good stuff. We've had recently an MP out of British Columbia made the case for the legalization of marijuana, or rather the decriminalization of marijuana. We had our coverage of Iran, the Iranian election was actually, I think, the thing I'm most proud of. Because we had some a very prominent activist, women's rights activist out of Tehran, writing an open letter published exclusively here, calling on other opposition groups in Iran to collaborate at this time. We had the field officer who was You might remember the story of the Canadian woman trapped in Kenya over the last couple of weeks. The NGO that was handling her case and basically shuttling her around as they were trying to get her on the plane to bring her home, they wrote an op-ed here explaining what had happened and what they thought. And on a lighter note, Melissa Ochtermar, who was the former bassist of the Smashing Pumpkins and of the band Hole, which was Courtney Love's band, she's from Montreal, and we talked to her about writing something about music, and she said, yeah, no problem, let's talk about it next week. And then when we got her on the phone to discuss it, she was in the doctor's office being diagnosed with swine flu. And we said, hey, would you like to write a swine flu diary? And she did, and it was great. She included, along with just her description of what was happening, she included some photographs of her room and the things she was using to get by. But that traveled very far and very wide. Ended up in the USA Today and every major Canadian newspaper. And so there are a couple of examples where we're trying to cover the serious issues and also trying to lighten it up a little bit so that people have some fun.
So you've already sort of mentioned this already. You talked about some of your contributors. Well, can you sort of go on into more detail about who they are and what they hope to achieve?
Certainly. Well, our contributors, at this point we have 450-plus contributors signed up. They are about 100 professors from across the country. They are members of parliament, like I said. All the think tanks are participating. It includes business leaders. It includes scientists, curators of art galleries, really people from politics, business, science, technology, sports, and the arts is how we break it down. And what are they hoping to achieve? I mean, ultimately, it's every politician with a platform, every author with a new book, every NGO executive director with a mission, every celebrity with a cause, entrepreneurs, lawyers, consultants, financial advisors, scientists who have new knowledge and new research and believe that the average Canadian news diet does not include enough science. It's people who are participating in small academic circles and believe, as we do, that all of that knowledge and all of that thought should be making it out to the general public, maybe in a different format, maybe, spiced up a little bit, which is what we do for them, but that, all of this knowledge is so interesting and there's no reason for the newspapers to only be publishing Reuters, Canadian Press, Newswire articles. Lowest common denominator stuff to sell papers. I think, one of the things that Obama demonstrated in the last U.S. election was that you can actually elevate the debate and still reach large numbers of people. And so that is, in effect, what we're trying to do. And at the same time, what our contributors are achieving for themselves is they're building a body of work online. They are enhancing, they're establishing their own credibility in a specific field. They are engaging with other experts and other people. They are essentially promoting themselves. And we don't publish advertorials. When I say promotion, and that can have a negative connotation, what I mean is they are amplifying themselves. And we support them in any way we can.
Well, you have all of these contributors, and so you're really at the heart, sort of the keystone of this ecosystem of thought and passion and ideas and things that are, like the hot topics of today. I mean, can you pinpoint some things, like in politics or business or science and technology?
You mean like the hot-button issues?
Yeah, the hot-button issues that, where you're seeing a lot of passion be driven from the audience. People are contributing back and saying, hey, I agree with you, I disagree. There's a great discussion going on.
Yeah, and one that might be of particular interest to this audience is Michael Geist and the people who are thinking about copyright and privacy. That is getting a lot of airtime and a lot of interest here at The Mark. The hearings have been going on about this. And so people seem to be get pretty passionate about that idea, about these questions. So yeah, that would be one. International conflict is certainly another. So we hosted a debate here about the coup in Honduras, which is might be a pretty obscure topic for some people, but was quite interesting. You know, I'd like to sort of step aside from that question and address what I think is a really interesting trend. You know, a newspaper had to contend with limited space, and what we are going to try to do over the next couple of months is tackle the long tail of content interests. So certainly you get your blockbuster topics. An election hits in Canada in the next few weeks. Everybody is focused on that. But we think there's a real opportunity to host conversations and discussions around topics that may even have very limited interest, but aggregate them all here at the Mark in one place and provide the tools around, you know, on the pages that host those conversations to really add some color. So, for example, we would allow the moderator of an individual discussion to add custom polls or data stats, just interesting stat of the day, or to break the page down into subtopics where discussion forums, where discussions could happen in specific forums and where users could be voting ideas up and down. You know, we can integrate all kinds of background information and breaking news and other things like that, all curated by human editors and all targeted at the 350 people who really care about privacy, copyright law as it relates to something quite specific. So I know I've sort of turned your question on its head and said certainly the hot button issues are important, but at the Mark, we are going to try to host hundreds of conversations about niche issues.
Well, that's interesting. You know, that means you're getting more at the grassroots. And what happens then is that you may get ahead of a story, which the major media haven't picked up at this point.
Well, 100%. And in fact, we believe that what is said on the pages that host these conversations, given that the things that are being said or are being written by very prominent, credible people, we think that that will be newsworthy. But I also think that the very fact that all of these conversations are happening at all in the format that they will be happening is news in and of itself. So, yeah, we will be certainly be hoping to get some media coverage that will help bring this site to life.
Well, you know, underlying the Mark is technology. So what triggered your interest in technology?
Well, first of all, I was in school at MIT, and you know, you can't certainly MIT is just a thriving, innovative, technological environment, and so many of my friends and colleagues were working at the Media Lab there, or in various labs that were doing absolutely revolutionary stuff. But you know, from my perspective, I'm not a technologist. I'm not an engineer. I come from a business and political background. So for me, the technology is really just an enabler of the vision that I have for the exploration and expression of ideas. That said, I am amazed not by the sophistication of the interfaces of the various technologies that we use. In fact, the opposite. I'm fascinated by just how very simple it is to integrate powerful tools into our offering with almost no integration time or effort. Also with almost no cost, given how much how everything is open source and or even not open source. I mean, the basic packages of different applications that we use are free, and of course, if we wanted to upgrade, we could pay. But yeah, I'm absolutely astounded by how much is out there, how simple it is to use and integrate, and just how powerful it is. And you know, I'd like to say two things on that. When I was at MIT, Vern Rayburn, who was one of the early employees at Microsoft, came to speak about his company. I forget what it's called now, but he was building like a 6-seat aircraft for a few hundred K or something. And somebody asked him, how is this aircraft going to be used? And he said that he said, look, I really don't know, but what I do know is if we build it, and if we build it so that it's, it can be acquired at a low enough cost, then the forces of innovation out there will figure it out for us. And we certainly see that at work in our own business, where you know, pieces of technology, pieces of software, or applications like Scribble Live or other things have been introduced to us. And certainly, they did not know that we would exist when they built the software. And we are applying it in as ingenious a way as we can imagine. And then, you know, just it goes from there.
You know, I'm going to sort of vector away in terms of, you know, the state of the economy in this country. You know, you got the mark, and you got your finger on the sort of the pulse of what's happening. It's so many different communities. So do you see the recession offering opportunities for innovation?
Absolutely. I mean, from our perspective, you know, for any of your listeners who have gone out and have tried to raise money for new ventures, either from VCs or from angels, you'll know that it's extremely difficult and it is very much dependent on people's appetite for risk. When I started raising money for this, in the six-month period, the first 6 months that I was trying to raise the money for the mark, the stock market dropped 40% or something. It was, I mean, just the worst time. But the flip side of that was that the recession was hitting everybody really hard. The established media companies were firing people, not investing in new ideas. You know, these were the big players that would otherwise be building the product that I'm building, maybe. So they were not doing that, which left some, you know, a wide open opportunity for us to jump in and grab it. Same thing with other people and competitors for us who might have been trying to raise money. It was extremely difficult. So we knew that had slowed down. Recessions present a ready pool of highly skilled people who are willing to work for less simply because they have been laid off or are having trouble finding jobs. And plus, in recession, everybody is weakened. So all the incumbents are weakened, and it usually means that people aren't profitable, and it usually means that the environment is ripe for disruption. And so we see our experience as having launched at the perfect time in a perfect storm, and we are well positioned to rise up from the ashes. So to answer your question directly, I would say a resounding yes. Periods of uncertainty are ripe for disruption.
I see. So you're saying periods of uncertainty are ripe for new opportunities to grow your business or to launch a business.
Well, I mean, that's course. And management theory says exactly that. It's you want to be investing and buying and building at the bottom of the trough and then ride the wave all the way up to the peak. So, yeah, certainly. Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing I would add there is we did talk about unprofitable businesses. Wherever companies are losing massive amounts of money, there is the need for a new system. So that would be one thing to look at. Another thing would be, sorry about the noise, the applications of new technology. So just being on top of what's coming out and trying to think about that. I mean, I think that's a lot harder. For me, what was really helpful was talking to people about what doesn't work in their businesses today, talking to VCs about the kinds of things that are getting funded, that kind of thing, and then it's just a whole lot of creativity.
There seems to be a lot of uncertainty there and this sort of very rapid pace and, I guess, change occurring everywhere in terms of the economy, our lives, and business, and science, and so on. So how do you manage all of that change?
I don't manage change. I ride the change. all right. Well, I guess I'm, yeah. I mean, change is, for us, change is the medium through which we build and grow. Because we are evolving with that change. In fact, I see us as the fourth and cusp of that change in our sector. So every day that things change, and to every additional degree that that change is happening, we gain. So that's that at a macro level. But internally, organizationally speaking, certainly change is a difficult thing to manage. People don't like change. They get comfortable, and change is very uncomfortable. So what I do here, and this is a very, very young organization, and I am a very young manager, but in the short time that I have been doing this, I try to make people feel as though they are the change, and have them lead the change and drive the change. And of course, in a small organization, it's a lot easier to do that than it is in a larger organization. But you know, we are always looking to be out ahead of that change, and that's what our MO is, to be out ahead of that change. So we recruit people who are comfortable in that kind of environment. You know, we are not recruiting people who have worked in very steady government jobs with clearly defined career paths and annual reviews. This is a company where you come in, and within 3 weeks, you're doing something a little bit different than what you expected you were going to do. And that is just the nature of the beast. So it's also a bit of a personality thing.
I see. So what you're doing is then embracing the turn, the opportunities that come with being agile, and looking at, you know, what are the things that I can do to take advantage of what's happening in this marketplace or in a particular sector, and so on.
Right, exactly. We know that we can move faster. I think we can move smarter. And so every incremental change adds to our advantage.
You know, I think you're perfectly situated because you're got your, as I mentioned, your finger on the pulse, the sort of of the grassroots that are out there in terms of innovation and ideas because of the mark. Can you make then your predictions for the future, the implications, and how we can prepare?
And specifically in what areas?
Business, technology, science, whatever you think is appropriate.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you. Again, I can speak most credibly about my own business. An idea that I think is really interesting is the move from, in publishing, the move from objectivity to transparency. In the past, newspapers have always pursued objectivity. We'll present the facts to you as they are. And you know, you can trust us that we will be objective. Frankly, I don't believe that that was ever possible, and it's certainly no more possible now than it ever was. And I think it's a bit of a futile pursuit. So instead, here at the Mark, and I think throughout the publishing world, we will begin to see transparency, or put differently, people who are open about their bias writing in their expert opinions instead of pursuing objectivity. And that's a trend that we are certainly capitalizing on, because we say, don't bother trying to give a balanced, quote in quotes, perspective on things. Better to give your opinion and acknowledge that it is your opinion, and let readers know exactly who you are and where you come from, and you know what your biases are. And so in that respect, there is a trend that I think you'll see taking root. Another thing is openness. And in terms of at least data, this is a fascinating topic that we've had a lot of people write about at the Mark, is the idea of open sharing of data, open government, you know, the idea that if the Canadian government made all of its databases open to the public. Coming back to that Vern Rabern idea, who knows what applications citizens would be able to devise, and how that would reduce the cost of running government, how it would impact our lives in myriad ways. So that's something that I think we will see more and more, is information and data being freed up so that the market, in a sense, the collective genius of all can be brought to bear. Now, I wonder if have you heard the example of what the Guardian newspaper did, crowdsourcing the analysis of members of Parliament's expenses?
No, go ahead, share.
Fascinating. They had 450,000 pieces of paper receipts from all British members of Parliament. And they built a website and said, you know, hey guys, the public, they said, hey, there's no way we, the Guardian, could throw enough bodies at this to analyze every single receipt to see if anything fishy or interesting was going on. So we're opening it up to you. Go to your riding, if you're interested. Look up the, look at all of these receipts. And if you find something interesting, flag it for us and we'll do some research on it. Within hours, they had 3,000 people sifting through these things, and essentially they crowdsourced, is the term that's being used, the analysis of all of these documents in a way that absolutely could not be done by any organization out there, at least not in a way that would be cost-effective. And, of course, they found all kinds of embarrassing and funny things. They were able to map it and get insights from it. So anyway, this is just one example of how, and this ties back to what I was talking about before, about going after the long tail, how you can find the, call it 100 people who really, really care about a particular issue. And they will be prepared to do all kinds of work and thinking that can generate some real insights. And so there's another trend there. I guess one other thing I would add here is just doing more with less. And certainly this is the a mantra here at the Mark, where we just have such limited resources. But again, it seems that there are so many tools out there, and so many people who get intrinsic satisfaction from doing specific kinds of work, and just with the tools, again, that are available. Like, you know, we run all of our email, and so many of the tools we use here as a company through Google, and all of it's free. It seems that you can do so much more with less, and it's probably a universal trend that you could track back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. But I wonder if it's accelerating now and whether it will continue to accelerate into the future. I certainly hope it does.
I guess the other trend that you're leveraging is this whole shift in publishing from traditional print to online, and I guess there's even a shift of advertising as well.
Well, certainly, and the key point there that I think is just zeroing in on, you know, there's so much talk about this, and a lot of people still don't understand what the problem is, and here it is. Advertising is sold based on a dollar per eyeball or dollar per user interaction. And so, for example, if you pick up the newspaper and you look at a particular ad, for argument's sake, say the newspaper will get paid $1 for every time you look at that ad in the print newspaper. Take that exact same ad and put it on your computer screen. Same person, same ad, same everything. And that ad is only worth 10 cents. So the newspapers, you know, the publishing world finds itself in a situation where readers are abandoning the print product en masse and relocating online, where the ads are only worth one-tenth as much. So if you're the publisher of one of these publications, you look at it and you say, okay, well, if I assume that print will eventually disappear, in order to maintain the same profit margins that I have right now, assuming we can't charge any significant amount for the content online, then I have to dismantle 90% of my cost. Certainly, if they dismantled all the print infrastructure, they could get some of the way, but you can imagine that taking away 90% of the cost is no easy feat, and I think that's why many of them have resisted over the last 10 years the move to online, despite the fact that it was clear, the writing was on the wall. They resisted it because they're locked in. And another thing most people don't know, the Canadian newspaper industry in 2008 derived 90%+ of its revenue still from the print business as of last year, despite the fact that 75%+ of the readers were online.
That's an interesting statistic. So very much gives you an idea how things are sort of shaping out there in Canada.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Things are changing quite rapidly. And well, we hope to capitalize on it.
And I really found quite fascinating your sort of this new model, I guess, for investigative journalism, where you crowdsource it.
Oh, absolutely. It's there are a lot of opportunities there. We are looking at a few. I won't say exactly what, but I think we're going to make some noise when this election hits now in Canada. Yeah, we're going to make some noise using crowdsourcing. Stay tuned.
We're coming to the end of this interview, so I'm going to kind of shift it around and say, if you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
That's a good question. Okay, well, I would ask about the Canada angle of all of this. I was living in the United States. I'd been working in Asia, and had some, I was living in New York, and was looking at jobs there, and started to think about the idea for the Mark. And at the time, I was calling it Speak Canada, and it was clearly a Canadian product. It was by definition a Canadian product. The people who would write for it would be Canadian. Its mission was to put Canadian ideas on the map. And part of the argument was that there was real opportunity in Canada. And when I started trying to raise money for it, talking to friends and advisors, people were saying, why Canada? Canada's so small, and aren't there more exciting places to be? And it was exactly that sentiment that I am trying to combat in starting the Mark. We say, you know what? The way Canadians think of themselves, the way Canadians are depicted in the media as a very timid people, as which is, of course, is true, and very nice and peacekeeping and hockey watching, beer drinking, a saying, all the great stuff that we are, misses a slice of the Canadian identity, a slice that is tech savvy, hyper innovative, hyper creative, globally competitive in whatever we do, scattered all over the world, doing at the forefront of our field and traveling to the far corners of the earth to pursue excellence. I mean, there are 2 million Canadians living abroad, and so many of them doing extraordinary things, either with the UN or the World Bank. I mean, I could go on. But the idea is that the Mark will try to illuminate to Canadians this part of our identity that we don't think gets enough airtime. And that, in addition to all the adjectives I just listed, there is has opinions and is proud to express them. We know what we think. Let's put that down on paper. And for so long, people have said, what does it mean to be Canadian? And we've toyed with the negative definition of not American. And what we are doing is, instead of trying to define what it means to be Canadian, we are building a library and a place where what it means to be Canadian is demonstrated through the totality of things that are said and written here. And that message is resonating with people from all professional disciplines. And they're saying, you know what? You're right. It's time that we maybe took ourselves a little bit more seriously. For example, when the at the Beijing Olympics, halfway through, we weren't winning any medals, and the newspapers were saying, "Well, we don't really want to win. We're more of a, we'd rather just participate." And while that may be true, there are a lot of people out there who fight pretty hard every day, either in their jobs or in their hobbies or other things, to be excellent. And it's those people and that excellence that we want to feature.
Well, I commend you on this, on these sort of amazing goals that you've set forward, and looking forward to the growth of the Mark. Jeff, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today, and especially with your demanding schedule. And we were really fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. Thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Well, I appreciate you saying all those inappropriately generous things. It was a pleasure meeting with you, and looking forward to talking with you again.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jeff Anders, International Innovation Leader and Strategist, co-founder and CEO of The Mark.